It's nice to sit here today. It felt very peaceful and simple. I don't know, just a simplicity to the day that nice. Like the light was nice, and maybe it's nicer to have fewer people. We should do this more often. Should have a cutoff. We should have a cutoff at 20. Lee asked me to announce that on May 17th there's going to be a memorial service for Ayakema. And Ayakema was a wonderful Buddhist meditation teacher and in many ways a pioneer for bringing Theravada Buddhist practice and tradition to the West. And there's going to be a memorial service for her. She died in November. And it's going to be at Green Gulch where she's taught and in the afternoon. And they're going to, different people, I guess, who knew her will talk a little bit about her. And if you didn't meet her, it might be nice to come and hear some of the stories, kind of to hear what she evoked in people. So, as I said this morning, what's been on my mind is a little bit this issue of questions and questioning and the role of questioning in our practice. And with some trepidation, I bring up the topic this afternoon because many of us are addicted to thinking a lot and figuring things out. And the topic of questioning lends itself to thinking, and off we go. But questioning is, I think, is a very important part of the practice, and in many forms of Buddhist practices that I've encountered, in Soto Zen, the Genjo Koan, the issue at hand, what is this that you were actually engaged in the moment, is the considered to be the essential koan for the Soto Zen tradition. Finding out what is the issue at hand, what is this? And that's kind of, you know, our question too in Vipassana, what is this? The investigation is one of the factors of awakening. Investigating, inquiring into the present moment, what is our actually lived experience of the active lived present? And questions can both help and hinder the process of clarifying the present moment, of coming more fully into the present moment. But they're very important. In my own practice, questionings have been very important, and been one series of questions after another that have not only informed my practice but also motivated it. I remember maybe the first question I ever asked a teacher was kind of informally. I asked a Zen teacher. I'd been introduced to Zazen and Zen meditation, and I asked him, what's the effort you make the practice? What kind of effort do you make in the practice? How do you make effort? What kind of effort do you make? And he answered, "Who's making the effort?" And that just went right by me. he hadn't answered my question. Just, what's this about? And maybe you can say that he planted a seed, because later, many years later, it kind of was an interesting, to reflect on why he said that or what he meant. But at the time, I'll forget this guy. Who's making the effort? I just want to know how much effort to make. and then I remember this, the first time I had a formal interview with a Zen teacher, where you meet in a kind of interview room and you sit facing each other in meditation posture. I was so afraid or so nervous that I couldn't speak, and the teacher had to say, "Breathe deeply, Gil. Just breathe deeply." And so I did, and after a while, maybe I said something. I don't have a clue what transpired. And one of the questions, one of the roles of questions, there's a whole category of questions that we can have, that are not questions that we bring to a teacher to get the clarification, or we ask a teacher for. Then it's not appropriate to ask them to a teacher. You might mention that you have this question, but they're more questions that propel a person in the practice or give a direction or movement for a person in the practice. So there are questions there to be answered in the living of them. There are questions to be where you're the only one who can answer them. So one of the questions that was very important for me in my early period of Buddhist practice, it kind of really propelled much of my interest in practice early on, was the question, how can I be alone with others? Because I had the experience of being quite alone at one point without anybody around me, kind of in real solitude for a week. And in that solitude, I felt tremendous intimacy with myself and the world around me, and a tremendous sense of well-being. And that got my attention, really seemed really precious and important. To be able to have that ability, to have that kind of intimacy and that kind of sense of well-being. And it would have been very easy, I think, to have been attached to that solitude and thought the solitude was the answer. I better go off and be a hermit. But I had enough sense to know that it wasn't that solitude wasn't the answer, because the problem was not community, but rather was the way which I interacted with community, with friends and people and stuff. And so my quest then became, how can I have this kind of ease together with other people? How can I have the sense of solitude, the sense of independence or freedom when I'm with people? And that felt like the, you know, real freedom. To just keep going off and being a hermit didn't seem like it was any, you know, it wasn't real freedom, it was just relief. So my early Zen period, that was one of the things that was propelling me in my practice, was this question how to find that ability in daily life and community of people. And as I kind of deepened in my Zazen practice, there also I felt this kind of sense of well-being, and I called it, this time I called it integrity, sense of integrity. And then the quest became, how can I have this kind of integrity that I find in the solitude of my own meditation? How can I find it also in my daily life with people around me? So that my fears and anxieties and my worries and my ways in which I build up a sense of self and defend it, the ways in which I, you know, all kind of complicated ways in which I got involved in everyday life. How can I have this kind of integrity in my daily life so all these kinds of things weren't triggered and weren't so active and getting in the way? And that became a real quest of mine. And I could have gone and asked a teacher those questions, but I never did. It was just, I knew that this is something I had to discover for myself, how to do this. After I discovered Vipassana practice, one of the propelling questions for me was that kept me, actually brought me back to Vipassana, and brought back to Asia the second time to do my long practice there. The question was, what is the self? And I felt a burning need to find out, what is this self, this thing called the self, what is it? And it didn't make any sense again to ask someone to tell me. It was something that, it was a kind of a question that had to be lived through or be discovered in the practice itself. And then at some point in the practice, for some reason, that question kind of receded in the background. And the question that came into the foreground was, how can I do this more thoroughly, most thoroughly? And that became kind of a propelling question. How can I do this practice? How can I discover this sense of accepting presence, of the present moment? How can I do that completely thoroughly? And I recognized how there was all kinds of levels of non-acceptance of my present reality. It could be quite gross, you know, I didn't like, you know, this cup of tea is too hot, you know, how could I, you know, who was it, he heated up the water, you know, it's too hot, or it's too cold, you know, or I mean, it could be all kinds of levels where we don't, it could be daily things we don't accept, or it could be aspects about ourselves we don't accept, and there's layers and layers and layers of non-acceptance upon which much of our normal personalities are built, I believe. And as I got a sense of this, my quest was, how can I practice this accepting presence as thoroughly as I could? And so then that propelled me, it gave juice and energy for me to practice during my long retreats in Asia. So there are certain questions which you don't bring to a teacher for an answer, but rather you live and you explore on your own. And I think it's worthwhile. Some people won't have questions like that, and it's okay. Or some people can't articulate them. But it's interesting the word question and quest are closely connected. The idea of a question, and also the idea of quest to me, for me, what's behind it is the idea that to settle on anything as being the answer is a hindrance. One of the functions of questioning, besides propelling us in our practice, one of the functions of questioning is that it encourages us to stay open to the possibilities of things we don't understand yet, to some other understanding, something else, something beyond, some greater, anything at all, anything beyond this particular formulation of our understanding, this particular formulation of the path or of realization, or this particular formulation of system or whatever. In some formal kind of institutional religious settings, the kind of sense you get when you enter the religion is seek no further. You know, this is it. Seek no further. You got it. And another way is to really keep seeking, keep seeking. And that's kind of my sense of my preferred sense for myself. And maybe because of that, I want to project it into Buddhism. You don't want to say you finally come to some finished, definitive system. This is it. You've understood. You know, seek no further. But rather, you want to have some kind of sense of practice that keeps opening you up to new possibilities. You know, to stay open. And this idea to stay open. Openness is not a system. Openness is not an answer. Openness is not a, because you can't point to it, you know. Openness is kind of like the door through which you walk to kind of discover a greater connectedness with life, a greater familiarity with life, a greater discovery of what life is. And I believe that discovery goes on forever. It never comes to an end. And what practice can do is to help you keep that door open. And the questioning mind, is a mind that serves a great function because it helps you ensure that you keep the door open. You know, what is this? And not to settle, but now I understand. This is what it's really all about. I got it now. I can just rest on my laurels. You know, but you know, maybe you don't know. Kind of, what else? What else is there beyond it? Or is there another formulation of it? Or partly to be on the guard of one of the great spiritual traps is to have a great experience, maybe some deep experience, and then live in the memory of it, the formulation of it, the idea that you've had. You know, you have this memory, this idea. I had this great thing, and then we live kind of as a badge, or kind of take refuge and think, oh, once upon a time I had this thing. You know, the questioning mind, is one that doesn't settle anywhere, but actually is constantly. In a sense, open. This idea is actually has. This goes maybe against a little what I'm saying, but is expressed in Mahayana Buddhism, where one of the forms of enlightenment or nirvana, is called non-abiding nirvana. It's a state of awareness that doesn't abide anywhere, doesn't settle anywhere, doesn't take anything as the resting place. The idea of not resting anywhere, not taking any place as being the answer, the thing, is considered to be really crucial in some forms of Buddhism. The point is not to rest anywhere, not to have an answer, but constantly to be open to what's next, to what's here. Now, there are some questions that can, in a sense, in the surface of the questions, can take us away from the present moment, can take us away from really understanding what's here. And there's some questions that can help move us towards opening to the present moment more fully. And learning how to distinguish between those two, I think, is very important. I think this morning I mentioned the distinction between two kinds of questions we can have towards our emotions, for example, our anger. And I get this kind of question a lot in my role as a teacher. People will come into an interview and say, I'm overwhelmed with anger, with all this anger. How can I work with my anger? And it's a great question. It often comes from a sincere place, the question. But the idea that you're going to work with the anger is like you're going to be given some tool, some answer for how to be with the anger. And in a very subtle way, it takes you away from the anger. It's kind of separation, actually. And a more interesting question, I believe, is the question, how can I be more present for my anger? How can I discover my anger? How can I enter into the anger more fully to really, with a process of discovery? I don't know if you can see the subtle difference, but to me there's a difference between the two. How can I understand my anger versus how can I work with it? And I think the process of mindfulness, the process of opening, is all constantly, in a sense, a process of understanding, of clarification. I like the word clarification because it doesn't necessarily mean, it has this implication beyond kind of understanding, becoming clear about something, kind of letting it be there in a clear way. That's why I like sitting in this room. There's all this, you don't see it because you kind of just look at, I look at all the clarity in the room. Maybe we should turn, next time we should turn around, and I should sit in the middle of the room and so you guys can enjoy. What I find interesting, you know, in my role as a teacher and getting interviews, is that I get a lot of people come with questions. I think there's a common assumption that that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to come with a question. Because sometimes people will come and apologetically say, I don't have a question. And I guess the assumption is they're supposed to have one. No one ever told me that. That the students are supposed to have a question. But anyway, that's the assumption. But I remember many times when I went to for interviews with my Zen teachers, after I got over my nervousness, I often didn't have, not only did I have any question, I didn't have anything to say. But not only that, but it actually felt there would be a loss of integrity if I said anything. It felt more sincere to sit there and just be there, present, in a full way, than it was to even say anything or describe anything or whatever. Part of the function of the interview is to actually have two people meet each other fully. And what form does meeting take? A lot of things can happen during interview. You know, it's not just, interviews are not just simply a place to ask questions. I mean, that's a great place to ask questions. It makes it a lot easier for the teacher if you come with a question. You know, the teacher can give the answer. Next. But sometimes rather than you having a question, another thing can happen in the interview is the teacher can ask you a question. And sometimes that's a valid thing. The student comes, I have no question, and I'm here, and do you have a question of me? Sometimes interviews are places for just not so much questioning at all, either direction. Sometimes a student will just come and report and say, this is what my experience is. And that's a wonderful thing, just to say, this is my experience, and you know, this is what happened in my meditation practice, and this is what I did, this is how I noted it, how I was aware of it, and I wanted to share that with you. And the teacher will say, well, that's great, or you might try something a little different, or it seemed to me you were a little bit, you know, you could have noted it more precisely or something. But sometimes kind of a student giving kind of a description in it, the anatomy of what it's like to do the mindfulness practice, is very useful for the teacher. It gives a better sense of what's going on with the student than if the student asks a question. So when I was practicing in Burma, we would go for interviews once a day, 6 days a week. And I did this for 8 months. I had a lot of experience with interviews. And it was very rare that I asked a question during interviews. Most of the questions I could have maybe asked would have been dismissed anyway. I often would ask, say, my questions that were more general for the Dharma talks, which would be in the evening. But the meditation interview had a very particular form. And all I was expected to do was to come and report what my clearest meditation experience had been in the last 24 hours. What my best meditation had been in the last 24 hours. And a common experience for a number of us Westerners practicing this way So we show up and we report, you know, well, dutifully. We're told to report the best meditation we had in the last 24 hours, and we dutifully do it. And then after a few days, we would want to say something like, but by the way, the rest of the time I'm a mess. The rest of the time things are going really difficult. And the teacher would usually say something like, you know, basically got the sense that he knew that he didn't have to, you didn't have to tell him that. He really knew that it was difficult to meditate, and you'd have hours of times where you'd be difficult, you'd be tired or sleepy, or you'd have a hindrance attack, or you'd be off fantasizing about being anywhere but Burma. And he knew all those things. But he didn't feel like he had to be engaged with you about with it. He didn't see it as a problem. What he was interested in was, and we kept identifying with the problems. You know, that's where we get caught up in our problems. That's really where our life is at. And, you know, we think we have to fix it. And he wasn't, partly, I think, kind of to loosen us up from being so preoccupied with our difficulties. And he would ask us for our clearest sitting, our best meditation. So it was very freeing to realize you can go to a teacher and he didn't care about your difficulties. In a sense, it was very freeing. You didn't have to do this confession. And also, but more importantly, I think, knowing that he was interested in the place of greatest clarity in our sitting, when we're most present, added a little bit of encouragement to pay more attention when we were paying the most attention. Which just fed, just reinforced that we were paying more attention. So it was great. It was kind of self-reinforcing, wonderful thing. And it was quite wonderful to do that. And all you can report, what you had to report, was what was really going on in the present moment, in the meditation in the last 24 hours. However, when I first started doing this reporting with my teacher, I had been a Zen student for many years by that time, and I found it very strange to talk about what had happened, because what had happened, it was already ancient history, and what could that have, what did that have to do with anything? I was, you know, what was happening now was important. This is where life was happening. It was like what's happening here, now, in the interview. Not what happened, you know, 12 hours ago. Who could care less about what happened 12 hours ago? And so it was actually, it took a while for me to kind of get over this disjunction between my Zen interviews, which were much more about being in the present with someone, and this Vipassana interviews, which were talking about the past, in a sense. So sometimes interviews are for questions, sometimes interviews are for just reporting how things are, and sometimes interviews are not interviews in the sense that you're interviewing someone who's an authority, or not interviewing someone who knows, or someone who can give you answers, but you're actually, it's not an interview at all, it's a meeting. And part of the function of the interviews is to have these two people meet. In Zen, they talk about it in kind of, you know, fancy language, and they say it's you know, two Buddhas meeting, Buddha meets Buddha, or two adults meeting. And part of what happens, I think, in a student-teacher relationship of almost any kind, of a spiritual kind, is that the student and the teacher both together have to learn how to see each other as equals. And part of what happens in ongoing relationship with a teacher for some people is, and it's sometimes unstated, and it's kind of, maybe not, the student doesn't even recognize it themselves, but part of what's going on is not the development of their meditation practice, which might be going on, but rather the student is learning how to see themselves or to present themselves as an equal to the teacher. And at that point, you don't, you know, maybe you don't need a teacher anymore. And sooner or later, I think all students should come to that point. At some point, you don't really need. You can still have respect the teacher. You can still go and ask questions, you know, politely, and maybe the teacher, you know, should. Oh, you can always. It's always useful to go ask other people questions. It's always good to have teachers you go talk to and stuff. And meeting as adults doesn't mean, or as equals doesn't mean that you stop visiting and hanging out and asking questions, but you're really meeting as equals. More dramatic way of saying this. Which maybe I shouldn't tell you, since I'm the teacher here today, is that you're supposed to kill the teacher. And the student's job is to kill the teacher. And now, you're not supposed to take that literally, of course. And what you're trying to kill is that part of, inside of you that, that holds the teacher up as, you know, as a teacher who has the answer for you. But the idea is to become an equal. But you yourself have a sense of, not that you know all the answers, but that you can rest in yourself, feel complete in a sense, or feel at ease in yourself. There's no fear in the encounter with the other. No projection of the encounter with the other. No need, no need of approval or need of support or need of anything from the other, but rather just kind of meeting. It's a beautiful thing to have these two people meet. So that's another thing that can happen in interview. Though to try to make that happen is, if you're trying to make that happen, if you come with the agenda, okay, now I'm going to go and meet the teacher as an equal. It doesn't work that way, my friends. You can't have it in an agenda, it just happens. But so question, bringing questions to a teacher, or to a friend, or to yourself. So a lot of people bring me questions, and I think every question a person brings is respect-worthy. There's no wrong question or inappropriate question. And part of the reason that I feel that way is that no matter what the question is, it's an expression of, in some way or other, it's an expression of some deep movement inside the person, some deep movement of life or something within someone. I've been on a teaching 10-day retreat, and on the fifth day of the 10-day retreat, someone will come in and sit down for interview and say, "I wonder if you could recommend a good book on Buddhism." Mm-hmm. Now, on the surface, this is a bit odd. Odd kind of question. What do you think you're doing here? The fifth day, it's like you're in the middle of, the retreat, and you're engaged in the practice, and moment to moment you haven't talked to anybody for 5 days, and you want to, and the most important thing, you're going to talk to someone for 15 minutes, you haven't talked to anybody in 48 hours since the last time you talked to a teacher, and you haven't talked to anybody for conversation for 5 days, and you come in and say, "Can you give me a reference?" It's a little bit, odd. But even that is actually quite significant. I think any question is significant because everything is connected to everything else in our psychic life. And so one of the things we need to do for ourselves and for and as teachers is to listen, what's really being questioned there? What's the motivation behind a question? And it could be that the person is afraid. And this is a way the person protects themselves. And they're not going to tell this teacher anything. But they feel they have to ask something. They have to come to the interview, so let's ask something really safe. So that's really interesting information to know. Or maybe the person is not afraid, but the person is for some reason has learned to hold themselves at a distance from themselves. And the way they have to doing that is spending a lot of time and thought. And so there's never really any settling, any real development of deeper intimacy. And so the person who comes, they're coming after 5 days on the retreat, they're still in their kind of street mind, normal mind of chatter and stuff, because anything else is uncomfortable because it means real intimacy with themselves. And so they're asking this question because it's an interesting question. In the street mind, that's an interesting question. But to listen, what's really being asked in any kind of question is very important. And what we do in formal, and especially on a retreat, what we're trying to do is try to learn what, how to say it this way, the way to use questions in practice, and the way a teacher uses them often, is to help us enter into the present moment more fully. So what is it about this question that can be answered in the present moment, in the lived moment? So if a person comes and say, I have this real problem at work with my boss. You know, how can I bring mindfulness to my situation at work? Well, that's a great question. It's a very sincere question. And you know, a teacher might give some suggestions, some practical advice of what to do. It maybe is helpful. But from the point of view of actually engaging oneself in the liberative practice, the liberation practice of mindfulness, being given little techniques of how to make work go a little bit better is not as profound as finding out in that encounter, in that moment, what is the real issue in the moment that question is speaking about? Because it's a concern the student has. So how do I, you know, so, well, what's really going on for you in the present moment when you consider the issue around your boss at work? Fear is what's going on. What is the fear you feel right now? What's happening right now? So there's a way in which in Vipassana, the teachers are often interested in asking, what is happening right now? What about this particular question is discoverable in the moment right now? What about it? What is a door in the present that question can open up? So sometimes it takes then reformulating the question away from something that's in the future or in the past, but formulating the concern into something that can be answered in your present moment experience. And that, I think, is really a part of the art of asking questions from the point of view of mindfulness practice itself, to turn the issue around to what can be asked right now and here, rather than into the future. And what you'll notice, I think, if you go visit a Vipassana teacher, especially on retreat, often that's what they'll do. They'll turn the issue around to what are you actually experiencing now. It's very effective. One of the things that a lot of things go on in interview besides the three things I mentioned before. Sometimes people come to interviews not to ask a question or get help with their practice, but sometimes people come to interview because they want contact and they want support. They want a sense of affirmation. They want to be able to be seen by someone. And so that's to be respected also, and it's a deep need that they have. But one of the forms it takes then is sometimes the story becomes more important than the question or the concern. The person doesn't really want to engage you in some kind of inquiry, but rather wants to tell a long story to the teacher. You'd go on, you know, my father did this, and then my mother did this, and then this happened, and this happened, this happened. It's really important for you to understand all this. And, so the teacher was following, following, following. And finally they say something like, and so the question I have is, what do I do when there's a lot of anger? And it's not clear to me always why I had to understand all this history about their father and their mother and their grade school teacher and all this, you know, the people they got angry with in the past, maybe, and this and this. And when they ask, you know, how can I be more fully with anger when I'm sitting on my cushion? I don't know if this is a good example, but sometimes I'm really surprised I wonder, why did the person tell me all that? And sometimes I think it's because not that they feel like you need to know it, but maybe the person really feels that they really want to be seen by someone. They haven't really been seen by anybody before. And this is a way of getting some real contact, and juicy, very, very, very useful contact, or juicy contact. So then the teacher needs to listen to that and take that into account and respect that need. But one of the beautiful things that in the arsenal of teachers, in the teacher bag, you know, is because we only have 15 minutes, you know, some of these interviews. And sometimes it takes a long time to go through their grade school teacher and junior high school teacher and high school teacher and college teacher and this and that, and, you know. And it's a little bit of a pity sometimes when a student spends 12 minutes of a 15-minute interview telling you a long story. Important as it might be for them, important as it is that the student needs to be heard, it's a bit of a pity when it leaves you only 3 minutes to have a real dialogue or discussion about, you know, practice itself or how to be engaged more fully in the present moment. Not to disrespect the need for telling a story, just when there's only 15 minutes, you want to get to the point. So my first Zen teacher, we would have interviews with him maybe once or twice a year. So it wasn't that often. And so one of the, one of the, instructions there was you should actually spend a lot of time with your question. And you should actually think about your question a lot. Reflect on it, think about it, sit with it. And separate the kernel from the chaff. So you can find just a kernel of the question. What's the kernel of the issue that you can ask? So when you came for your interview, you can ask the kernel of it rather than, you know, the elaboration of it. And I found that very useful to do that. And one of the miraculous things that happens is when you actually spend a lot of time trying to find yourself, what is the kernel of this issue? You can figure it out for yourself. And one of the things that teachers do, and one of the things I do with many of you, is sometimes rather than answering a question with a question, I'll answer a question with a question. I'll just start asking questions, series of questions about what's going on. Not because I necessarily know the answer even. It's a great, you know, when I don't know the answer, it's a great technique, you know. Here, give you a few questions. But I think it's actually quite profound and actually a very important part of the role of a teacher is not to give answers easily, but actually to ask the kind of questions that helps a student begin discovering for themselves what they know for themselves. So to ask questions is actually very useful. You know, what's going on? What do you... kind of help look at the new perspectives and help draw out the wisdom and understanding of the student. But one of the things that a teacher can do, especially if there's a long narrative, the person is going into the story for a long time, one of the most powerful things to do is to kind of gently interrupt and say, what are you actually feeling right now? What's the actual experience you have in the present moment around this whole story you're telling? And you see, in doing that, the question is, how to get back into the present moment? Because a person can tell a long story, and the kernel of the feeling around that story is fear. And it's the fear that needs to be addressed, not the whole story. And what really needs to be seen and acknowledged is not the story, but what needs to be acknowledged is the fear. And sometimes it can be, even if a person really needs to make contact with someone, they actually make deeper contact if they meet in the feeling than if they meet in the long story. And it's the feeling where there's the real possibility of some kind of deepening insight, because the feeling is in the present moment. And the present moment is where this opening is going to happen that allows us to live in this non-abiding freedom, this place that doesn't abide in any place. There are questions which are not useful. One of the questions that's not useful is, what's wrong with me? It doesn't open any doors, I feel. Because most people feel somewhat, feel like something's wrong with them. Mostly, everything's right with them. But we kind of center, we kind of harp on that. So that to use the issues of your life to raise a question that helps you enter the present moment more fully around that issue, I think is one of the functions of questioning. When we get questions, when we do have questions, or when we formulate questions that really are central to our life issues, to our life practice, one of the ways to work with a question is not to look for an answer, but rather to become sensitive to the feelings, the emotions that seem to interpenetrate the question. So, for example, I can't think of a good example. Partly I'm distracted by the fact that it's 5 o'clock. So those are just my thoughts. It's kind of a free association on the topic of questions. And I think that it's had its role, but you should be careful. They're very important, the questioning mind. I've quoted often a little quote that I like. Trust those who are seeking. Trust those who seek the truth, but not those who found it. And this idea of always, you know, searching and looking, I think, is really key. So the idea of questioning is very important, but a warning I offer you is be careful, at least in the formal practice, that the questioning doesn't become discursive and you end up thinking a lot. One of the great arts of using questions is to get as quiet and as still as you possibly can, as concentrated as you can in your sitting. And if there's some issue you need to find, kind of resolve in your life, it can be like an issue like, which job do I take, or should I quit my job, or something. It can be some decision you have to make. See if you can get as quiet and concentrated and still in your mind and your heart as you can. And then pop the question. But not to think about it, but just notice what happens when you pop the question. What happens in your body? What resonates in your body when you pop the question? What feelings happen inside of you when the question arises? And sometimes when you pop a question, like in a very still mind, an answer arises from an unknown place. And it's great to have this unknown source for answers. Some of the most important decisions I've made in my life arose from this quiet place. And the description was the answer arose, or decision arose from within my body. It's like it kind of welled up from my body, the answer. And it felt so right, I had no choice but to do it. But I'd spent a lot of time thinking about it, you know, and that didn't seem to help at all. But when I have a certain level of concentrated calm, and a question arose in that space, and the body presented the answer, it was quite powerful, and it felt this was the right thing to do. And I look back at now the various decisions I made that arose from the body in that way, still seem like the right thing to have done. So, any comments or questions? Yes.
Is there a difference between questioning and contemplation?
It doesn't have to be a difference. They can overlap in that. But questioning itself is just having a question, just kind of the inquiry there. Where they overlap is when the questioning opens up to reflection. We're reflecting and thinking, contemplating about something. And there's certainly a place for that. Questioning doesn't have to open up to contemplation or to reflection. Questioning can open can point to feeling our way into the question, or feeling our way into the issues that the question evokes, or feeling our way into where the question points to. So the question, which, you know, the basic Vipassana question is, what is this? What's going on right now? What's this? And so rather than contemplating, reflecting on what this is, we feel or sense our way into what that present moment is. But certainly you can also reflect on it, you know, this, what's going on now, and thinking about it. So they overlap. They don't have to be the same, but they can be the same. Yes?
A couple of times in the last year I've heard Zen teachers talk about living the question. And when I've tried to do that as a practice, what I found was there was an identification then with the question. Now, they talked about allowing it to arise and then living with it. And the allowing part was probably fine, but then there was this effort of remembering what my question was and hanging on to that one question.
What was your question?
My But it became a thing. You know, it became, this is my question.
Obviously, since you can't tell us. It couldn't have been very important. You can't tell us.
It's very important. That's why I'm not going to tell you. I'm not sure I remember.
As I said, it probably wasn't so important. Yeah, I don't know what those teachers were saying, but living the question.
One was Richard Baker. That's a video.
Yeah, I don't know what he was talking about. Except that one of the meanings of living the question is not living the question, but a living question. Be a living question.
Baker taught questions hanging on to the question.
Then don't do it.
That's my question.
It's not useful, don't do it. Did he give an example of a question that he carried for 6 weeks?
He did, but I don't remember what they were.
Steve?
Well, I don't want to particularly promote thinking of it. It seems to me that process where you let the answer well up is often aided by, if it has been preceded by, a lot of thinking.
I think so. I think so too. That there's a certain amount of momentum behind the question, the issue, that comes from being engaged also in a thought way. And some of these deeper issues that I make decisions about, I think very much that that it was only possible to get the kind of deep answer because of the momentum, because of the amount of time I spent before thinking about and reflecting on it. But then I needed also to have that, once there was enough momentum that way, or something, then the deeper stillness and quiet allowed for some integration or something to happen that wouldn't have happened if I was just, you know, never thought about it and just some, you know, casually asked the question. I think it's a very important point. And I think there's a very important place in our life for reflection and thinking about things and mulling things over. That's partly what Richard Baker's talking about, is mulling things over as they... And we mull things over, but we don't expect the answer to come from the mulling. And then something else might happen. But as I said in the beginning, you know, it's a little bit tricky in our environment to promote thinking when so many of us are struggling with our thoughts and our meditation. Ideally, we understand that in certain areas of our life, it's very valuable to think and reflect. In other areas of our life, we have enough freedom that we don't have to bring that thinking with us into those areas. So we have enough freedom that we're not caught by our thoughts. And so when we sit, we don't have to be so actively involved in thinking. So I find that there's certain areas of my, certain times in my day that I actually will intentionally reflect and think. And sometimes when I drive in my car, I find it a great time to think. And I cherish my thoughts. I think they're great to have thoughts. Or sometimes when I go running, it's also a great time for thinking. I love it. You know, all kinds of great ideas come up, and you know, it's just a great time to think. Meditation time is not the time where I want to think. Bill?
You talk about thinking. I used to engage in a process where I would have to design a set for a foot. And I found that thinking about that was absolutely useless. I had to do all of the research. I had to read the book, I had to go to the library, look at all the pictures, get all the ideas I could. But if I sat down and thought about it, it was useless. And I think that's what you're talking about. You're not talking about thinking. You're talking about looking at all your possibilities. But if you sit down and think about it, you're tying yourself up in a knot. And if I pulled all that stuff into my head and then I forgot about it and went out with my bicycle, or you know, went out in the woods and went for a walk, then what I needed to know and the kernel of the idea that eventually began to be succinctly sort of grew out of it like a flower out of the ground or something. Sometimes it was just like, it was like a flash of light when it would come.
Yeah.
And that's just an analogy. if I sit down and think, well, what am I supposed to do about this? I'm tied up. If I look at all of the possibilities of what I could do and then forget about it, then what I should do comes to me.
There's many ways which different minds work, but that's it works that way in some ways for me also, is that if I'm going to be writing something, I'll have in mind that I'll have to, a theme that I have to kind of address, and or Dharma talk sometimes, you know, I'm going to decide I'm going to talk about something, and so there's a certain momentum, there's kind of oomph, a kind of, and so then as I go through my days, thoughts and ideas or reflections, or I'll pick something, I'll pick up a magazine and there'll be something, wow, this is exactly what, you know, speaks to my issue is and what I'm looking at. And then somehow it's like the intention of the intention of having this question, or maybe this is what Richard Baker was talking about, the intention of having a certain issue that's up is like a magnet that begins organizing things around it. And then at some point, when there's enough momentum of stuff that's integrated around it, and the right conditions, I find that new insights or understandings will kind of just bubble up inside my mind. And so if I sit down to think about these great ideas, I can't. But you know, who knows where ideas come from? It's interesting that in some of the older ancient Buddhist texts, there's frequent references to voices in the sky. Voices in the sky are these, you know, who knows what they are, but you know, maybe they thought there were gods living up in, you know, who spoke, and they spoke all this wisdom, and then, you know, and I suspect that one of the understandings of this kind of thing is, in the ancient times people had the same phenomenon as we do, is these new thoughts would suddenly arise, and they're good thoughts, and make a lot of sense of things, and explain a lot of whatever, and great insights, but they just seem to arrive out of nowhere. And they didn't identify with them. They didn't think, well, I'm the one who had that thought. Since I didn't have that thought, it had to come from somewhere. It's just a voice in the sky. Just, that's where, you know, and so they explained a lot of these insights they had from being voices they heard. I don't know. Yes?
I think the thing that I like about questioning is part of the practice is that if I have like an issue going on in my life or something that's occupying my thoughts and it keeps coming up, if I actually sit with it and kind of sink into the feelings and what it all is, often it will be like, should I do this or not, you know? That by literally just kind of giving myself to it, that the answer that wells up is never yes or no. It's, you know, it's like it's creative usually. It's like when I finally, you know, sit with it and sink into it, then I'll get an answer, but it's usually something completely different than what I thought about. It's much more integrated. It's that process that I find, if I do it, actually consciously sitting down thinking, okay, I'm just going to, this is obviously what's here, then I get that other response.
Nice, yes. We call it a day,
mm-hmm.
Or a part day, or whatever it is, a one day.